We're delighted to welcome with us this morning students from Craig High School. Could they please stand? You may be seated. The students are here with a program sponsored by the State Bar in this court. The program is entitled Court with Class. And the high school students from around the state are invited to attend an oral argument. And if they accept the invitation, they are sent briefs relating to the case and may engage in activities concerning the case in addition to reading the briefs. They then come to the court for the oral argument and meet with a justice at noon. Everyone is invited to attend that session at noon. A discussion is had about the process and procedure of the court, not the substantive issues of the case. If anyone would like a summary of this case, doesn't have it, the marshal will bring it to you. Would you just raise your hand if you need any materials? Thank you. Let me introduce the court to each of you. Starting on my left is Justice Lewis Butler. Seated next to him is Justice David Prosser. Seated to my immediate left is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my right is Justice John Wilcox. To his right, Justice Patrick Crooks. And on the far right is Justice Patience Rogensack. The class will meet with Justice Crooks at the end of the second oral argument. Also visiting with us is Chai Guling. I probably mispronounced your name, also known as Stuart. He is an intern with the State Ethics Board and is accompanied by the director of the State Ethics Board. And he's participating in an exchange program between China and the University of Wisconsin Law School. We're delighted to welcome you, if I may call you Stuart. And as some in the courtroom may know, the University of Wisconsin Law School has a program of exchange on Shanghai judges. And indeed, the judges are here this next couple of weeks, so we're delighted to have you with us. You may be seated, Mr. Stuart. All right, with those introductions made, I'll now call our first case, 038P1732, 038P2127, Gloria and is it Pinskowski versus Milwaukee County. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Pinskowski, for 15 minutes will be Alan Markovitz. For 10 minutes will be Andrea Roschke. And then we're going to have 30 minutes by Timothy Karakushik. How close am I to your name, sir? Okay, Karaskevich. Thank you, counsel. For 30 minutes, and then Mr. Markovitz for 5 on rebuttal. Everything in order here? Okay, Mr. Markovitz, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Ms. Roschke and I have divided the argument into two logical components. I'm going to be speaking to the just compensation issues, and she will be speaking to the relocation issue, which is embedded within the case. Thus, I'll be dealing with the first two points raised in our brief, and she'll be dealing with the third. I'd like to begin by reviewing the conflicting legal positions that the parties have advanced to the court regarding the acquisition of the two adjacent properties to the subject property that was taken here by the county. There is really no argument between the parties that absent some special reason to not consider the sales of these properties, these would have been classic comparable sales in a normal setting. Because of their proximity, this is the property on either side of the subject property. The position that the owner has taken and advocates here is that a voluntary sale to an entity which possesses the power of eminent domain should be admissible. The county has taken the position that there can never be a voluntary sale to an entity possessing the power of eminent domain, and thus there are no circumstances under which the evidence of that sale would be admissible.
Mr. Markovitz, was this property voluntarily, as you would say, sold to Milwaukee County for the airport expansion?
I have to put a temporal component to it. At the time that it was purchased by Milwaukee County, it was not purchased, in our view, for airport expansion. Eventually, after the properties had been owned by the county for a period of time, they were improved with parking facilities, and then when the subject property was purchased, the two adjoining properties were conjoined through the subject property to create one unified parking area.
At the time of the voluntary sale, was there county documents indicating that the airport would be expanded and that it would include this?
We don't believe there were. The most that the county has ever been able to point to is that they had this rough plan which said perhaps maybe someday we might and so on. It's our position that in order for a public project to be undertaken by any governmental body in the state of Wisconsin, there is a regular formal procedure that follows. There are public hearings, there is information made available to the public, and among other things that occur, a relocation order is adopted.
I have a third question. How do you introduce these other sales? Do you have the seller of these other properties come and testify, or is it part of the appraisal report? How do you introduce them?
Under normal circumstances, evidence of comparable sales would come in through an appraiser.
Right.
The appraiser would come in and say, I've searched, I have found, I submit, this is a comparable sale, it's sold from A to B, it's sold on such and such a date, it's sold for such and such a price, and then there would be a more in-depth analysis by that particular appraiser.
And he would, I assume, in the in-depth analysis, and then when you ask him the expert opinion, it would be fair market value based on a voluntary free sale at arm's length, et cetera, right?
The typical way in which it occurs, absent some pre-trial motion, like a motion in limine, is the appraiser will testify that he has used this particular comparable. He found it to qualify under his definition of a fair market transaction, voluntary transaction, and so on. Then, of course, would be subject to cross-examination.
Arm's length.
Right.
Right. Okay. Now, that's what his testimony would be. Okay.
The reason in this case, and the majority, I'm talking about the Court of Appeals in the trial court, Judge Gooley, said that, no, you can't introduce this because we're basically dealing with a eminent domain, a situation of non-voluntary. Your argument is, and I'm talking about all the cases going back to the Blick case, which I think was 1923, is that in this case, it was voluntary. Am I correct up to that point? Now, my question is this. When you read, at least when I read the facts, was it known generally that this was for, quote, airport expansion when these properties were taken, you know, the one that was north of your property and south?
I'd like to answer your question in two parts. First, in our role as counsel for the owner of this next-door property, they had no knowledge or information of why this property was purchased. There was no information. But I want to add, if I may, there are really two issues involved here. The first is a purely legal issue, and that is, can evidence of a voluntary sale to an entity which possesses the power of eminent domain ever be adduced by one of the parties involved in the lawsuit?
What do you mean by adduced?
Submitted.
Okay. Submitted as admissible as opposed to relied upon by the appraisal expert.
In my experience, whatever the appraisal expert relies upon is always open to the test applied to the jury, which weighs and evaluates all of the evidence. The jury is free to disregard all of the evidence submitted by an appraiser, some of the evidence submitted by an appraiser. That's part of the role of the jury.
What do you do with 90703, which is the rule of expert testimony that indicates, and I'm speaking now generically, that an expert can rely, can use testimony, not rather testimony, can use information in coming to an expert opinion, as long as that information is reasonably relied upon by someone in his field, even though the information is not otherwise admissible or is not admissible? How do you – that's why I asked you about adduced, because it seemed too broad of a term.
We made Your Honor's argument during the motion in limine proceeding before Judge Hayes, long before the case progressed to Judge Gooley when Judge Hayes retired. We made that argument under 90703.
Did you
rejected by the court.
Did you argue that it was the dollar amount was admissible? Is that what you made?
Yes.
Okay. You didn't indicate that it could be relied upon in arriving at an appraisal, but
we made that argument. We made both of those arguments.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them were rejected. The point I wanted to complete, if I can, is that we believe that the better approach is not an automatic barring of the evidence, but rather one which permits the evidence to be submitted by the party seeking admission on the basis that the sale was voluntary, and then let the other party combat that. By that, I'm saying that there's a pure legal issue here. That is the never rule.
Mr. Markovitz, let me, while you're on that point,
please
ask you this question. I'm interested in the time frame. I'm interested in, you're saying that these are voluntary sales. They're before airport expansion. The sellers had no knowledge that there was going to be airport expansion. How long before the airport expansion started were these sales made?
Well, if you talk about airport expansion being the paving of the parking area, which occurred, I believe, in 2000. One of these properties was acquired in 1997. The other was acquired in 1998.
Thank you.
Within 2 or 3 years of the...
Within 2 or 3 years. But I would put it the other way. I'd say more than 2 or 3 years prior to this project getting up and running. But putting aside for the moment whether it's all part of one project, the factual issue of whether or not the sale is truly voluntary or is not truly voluntary is a factual issue. That's to be determined on evidence to be considered by the trial court.
Let me just double back so I understand this. The appraiser gets on the stand. The appraiser's going to say the property is worth X $100,000. You're going to take him or her through the paces of saying, on what did you rely? And one of them will be the other properties that were sold to the Milwaukee County, right?
Yes.
And you'll say, is it voluntary and blah, blah, okay. And you want to put that on the stand. And the judge wouldn't let you do that. Is that what happened here?
Well, again, it happened in two parts.
Okay.
Because under normal discovery in condemnation proceedings, the other party has your appraisal report long before the trial.
That's under the statute.
That was brought in on a motion in limine. The county anticipated from reading our original appraisal reports, of which there were two, in which both of those appraisers relied in part on these two sales, that there was going to be an issue. And the county chose, and I think properly so, chose to raise the issue long before the jury trial. They put it forth in a motion in limine. We dealt with it. We believe we submitted ample evidence to the trial court in the motion in limine indicating the voluntary nature of these sales, But he ruled as a matter of law that it didn't make any difference to him whether we considered him voluntary or even whether the county considered it voluntary. He said there can never be admitted into evidence in Wisconsin.
You would have liked to put him on the stand, go through all this, tell him he would say it's voluntary, and then on cross-examination, the county would show or try to show
that it wasn't.
It wasn't voluntary, right? And then would you have other people testify as to voluntariness, or you have the jury determine voluntariness just on the basis of the expert and the cross-examination? Is that? I want to know how it would play out if the court holds in your favor, Mr. Markovitz.
If I could write the script of how this should be played out, I think that this issue should be presented to the court in the absence of the jury. Ideally, I would want this presented in a hearing associated with a motion in limine, in which all of the information could be brought forward by either party on the degree of voluntariness or the opposite. And I think the judge, the trial judge, could rule before the issue is ever close to being presented to the jury, evidence of these sales can be admitted because I find under the circumstances of this case that I am satisfied that these were voluntary. If the opposite conclusion is there and the sales cannot be considered, then you would have a variation of what actually occurred in this case, because after Judge Hayes ruled that the appraisers could not refer to these sales, there was still time for those appraisers to redo their reports, eliminate reference to that, and come to a completely different conclusion, which is the one that the jury eventually was able to hear. Now, I want to point out another thing to dispel something that someone asked me about just 2 weeks ago, and it was put to me this way. Well, isn't this a one-sided rule that you're advocating on behalf of the condemnee? And I said then, and I will say for purposes of argument now, this rule that we're advocating, that is a truly voluntary sale to a party possessing the power of eminent domain, is not a condemnee's rule. We believe it's a rule of evidence, and it could just as easily be submitted by a condemnor whose appraiser wants to use this kind of a sale as support for the conclusion that that side of the case may have drawn. Now, what we're asking for in this case is really for the court to rule that under appropriate circumstances, this is the kind of an issue that can be put before the court, and the court will inquire as to the voluntary nature of it. We are not asking this court to effectively reverse anything that occurred here because we're asking for a new trial. We're not here asking that an alternative jury verdict be put into place.
Mr. Markovitz, if I could, I'd like to follow up on Justice Bradley's earlier question. You pointed out that you argued the 90703 argument in the trial court. I'm looking at Judge Hayes' decision in Appendix 137 and 138 of your brief, and he seems to have dealt with that issue. I look at the briefs that were presented by both parties here, and neither of you appear to cite 90703. And so my question is, should we disagree with your position, have you abandoned the 90703 argument in this court?
I wouldn't say we've abandoned it. We consider the other arguments we made to be more compelling than the 90703 argument. We appreciate, with the history in this state, that for the court to now articulate a rule which says, we will allow evidence of a voluntary sale to be put in if you can prove that it's voluntary, that represents a departure from what we believe to be a limited reading of past precedents. That limited reading, we believe, failed in the trial court and in the Court of Appeals to be distinguished on the basis of the type of sale it was. We've pointed out in here that there are three ways in which property can be conveyed to a condemnor, one of which is a purely voluntary sale, one is a straight condemnation acquisition, and the third, of course, is a sale under threat or in lieu of condemnation. We are asking only in this one limited circumstance that it go that way. And if I can have just one more minute, I just want to make one point on the second argument before I turn it to Ms. Roschke, if I can
do that. Quickly, sir. Quickly.
I will. Turning to the second point, which is the so-called Hertz evidence, I want the Court to be aware of the fact that we had a theory as we presented our case. Our theory was that the highest and best use of the Pinchkowski property was assemblage for an airport-related commercial use. We had three pieces of evidence which we wanted to submit in support of our pursuit of just compensation. First, that the highest and best use was assemblage of an airport-related commercial use. Our appraiser was allowed to say that. The second thing, we wanted to point out that there was a significant interest from a private party to acquire the property in an assemblage for an airport-related commercial use. And we also wanted to confirm that significant interest through an admission that occurred in the owner's appraisal report. We were barred from presenting this evidence of just compensation to the trial court because the court ruled that our experts could not testify about the sale of adjoining property in support of the assemblage theory. We were not allowed to place into evidence the redacted offer from Hertz, which we intended to put in only to show that they had an interest in acquiring the property for assemblage purposes, not the price that they wanted to pay for it. And then we were barred from cross-examining the county's own expert, who in his report, and you have a copy of it, confirmed that Hertz's interest was in acquiring this property for assemblage.
Thank you, Mr. Markowitz. You'll have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Roschke.
Good morning. I'm Andrea Roschke, and I've been working with Mr. Markowitz, particularly at the appellate level, representing Mrs. Pinchkowski. And as he mentioned, I would like to talk about the issue of the housing replacement payment, the relocation benefit. What he's been talking about is just compensation. As you know, that's the constitutional requirement for compensation for property taken. What I'm talking about is purely statutory. Relocation benefits are in Chapter 32, and there's something on top of, in addition to just compensation. A few particular categories that the legislature has looked at and decided that people who are condemned may need additional funds to make them whole, to enable them to proceed. The point of this
Council,
being... Yes.
I didn't fully understand when I went through the briefs this idea of carve-out. Are you going to be touching on that?
Yes, I'm going to. And I'm going to touch on it without ever mentioning a dollar figure, and hopefully we'll be able to understand what this is about. But the basic point of relocation being that no matter how much just compensation you receive, your relocation is not necessarily going to go down commensurate with that. So to the extent the county is trying to make the argument that the Pinchkowskis received a windfall, they got a lot of money, they don't deserve any relocation, that's not accurate, because those are two different concepts. The carve-out is a component of a specific benefit. That specific benefit is the housing replacement payment. And what the legislature is trying to do here is look at, in the simplest scenario, someone who loses their home, they want to look at the dollar amount that they were paid for the property, and then they look at comparable properties. How much is it going to take for this person to go out and buy a property, a comparable house? And if there's a difference, we're going to give you that difference. There's a statutory maximum on that, but the threshold, the basic idea is, how much money do we need to give you so you can go out and buy a house? Life isn't always that simple. And this isn't mentioned in the statutes, but it is mentioned in the administrative code. Sometimes people are paid a large chunk of money, and not all of that is attributable to the house. And the code, for example, has identified three areas where you have to do this carve-out. One is where you have a large piece of property with a very, or with a home, large or small, with a home on it. But not all the value, not all the just compensation that you're getting has anything to do with the home. It has to do with the larger parcel. Another example of that, which also applies to the Binkowskis, is you have a property with a higher and better use, i.e., you're not being paid because that property has a house on it. You're being paid because there's some other intrinsic value there that hasn't yet been realized. And the third category, which doesn't apply to Pinkowski, but actually I think is easier to visualize, is where you have two uses on a property. Say somebody operates a mom-and-pop motel. They have a residence in the motel, and they have 30 motel units. If they're paid just compensation for that property, only a very small amount of that has anything to do with the resident, or in that particular example, or a tavern with a residence above it. So the legislature or someone in the administrative code designed this carve-out concept. And the whole point of carve-out is to make sure that the residential property owner or the owner of a residence, the inhabitant and owner of this residence, doesn't get lost in the shuffle. The fact that they're entitled to some relocation in terms of a housing replacement payment doesn't get lost because they're getting this big chunk of money. So the relocation agent, who works for the condemnor, goes out and determines the carve-out value. Well, what is the value of this particular small residence in the Pinkowski example versus the whole parcel? And they attribute, the county does this, the property owner has nothing to do with this, they attribute a dollar figure, not a percentage, but a dollar figure to what they think the value, kind of the contributory value of that house is. And the whole point of this analysis is then when they want to give you a housing replacement payment, they don't look at the big chunk of money which you received for the whole property with the motel and the residence or the residence and the liquor store. They look at the small dollar figure which the county has pulled out as the carve-out value, and they compare that to what is it going to take for this person to go out and buy a residence. And if your car, even if you're paid $1 million for your motel, you could have a carve-out value of your residence of $80,000. But if it's going to cost you $100,000 to go out and buy a home, a single-family, comparably spaced home in your area, they're going to pay you the 20. So whether you receive $500,000 for your property, $1 million, $2 million, you arguably may still be entitled to that housing replacement payment based on the carve-out.
What's your dollar? How do you apply that to this case?
Here, this, what the county is saying is you don't look at that dollar figure. Well, let me step back one moment.
But do it the way you want it done, then we'll do what it can.
In this instance, Pinkowski's got this paperwork that said they were entitled to a housing replacement payment based on a carve-out. They went out and bought a home.
And that figure was in the 50s.
That was 100.
That was 155, I think, is what they paid. What they paid. The allowance was, the carve-out was like $50,000. But what happened in the interim was the county upped their offer. This didn't happen at the stage of the jury trial. This happened during the period of good faith negotiations, in essence. The county went from less than a $100,000 offer to an award three times that. But that what the county is wanting to do is to apply a percentage. So your carve-out is now three times as big as it was originally. And what we're saying is, one, there's no authority to change a carve-out in the statutes or in the code, and two, in particular, in this situation, it doesn't make common sense. This was a commercial property. It was a non-conforming use. It was raised for a parking lot. That house did not go up in value to the extent that these people should lose their housing replacement payment. That figure, that dollar figure of approximately $50,000, should remain fixed. Otherwise, these people lose out. And that goes against the grain of relocation and carve-out.
Does it make any difference that the house was a non-conforming use? In other words, I understand this was zoned commercial, but the house, does that make any difference?
It just adds to the effect that obviously the value was not in the house. This wasn't like a house with hidden Frank Lloyd Wright windows that no one discovered until later down the pike, or that sought-after second bathroom that nobody realized was there. The additional money was not in the house. The additional money was in the appraiser's analysis that this property had commercial value. And in this particular context, it makes no sense to apply a percentage, jump up the carve-out, and then these condemnees get no housing replacement payment.
How do you address 3219-4A1?
Which is the computation of a housing replacement payment?
Such payment includes only the following: the amount, if any, which when added to the acquisition payment equals the reasonable cost of a comparable replacement dwelling available on the private market as determined by the condominium.
We answer that by going to the administrative code. That's where you find the carve-out provisions. The administrative code clearly says you don't look at the amount awarded for the whole property. You carve out a tiny amount, or doesn't have to be tiny, you carve out an amount that's attributable to the residents. Then you plug that in to the formula that's in the statute. The statute contains 2 pages of relocation rules and regulations. The code has a chapter. And the whole carve-out theory, which the county definitely followed and did correctly up to a certain point, is found in the administrative code provisions. And then they're totally indecipherable, but if you pick them apart and diagram the sentences, what they're telling you is, into that statutory formula, don't plug in the big number that the people received for the entire property. Just plug in the carve-out.
Who promulgated the administrative rule?
I would guess the Department of Commerce. I honestly don't know.
Who actually executed that rule in this case?
A relocation agent for the county.
Wasn't it reviewed by the Department of Commerce?
No. No. The Department of Commerce, if you have a condemnation project, the Department of Commerce looks at your overall plan that you intend to give people relocation. Then the agent goes out under the auspices of the county and allocates all the actual dollar amounts. And this only came back to the Department of Commerce because Pitkowski's did appeal to the Department of Commerce at a later point. And that's allowed, and then we went to court, and we've consistently lost on the issue.
But the point is the Department of Commerce, in interpreting its own rule, denied your claim, didn't it?
Well, it's a legal position, which obviously this court could overrule the Department of Commerce, and so could the trial court have. So I'm not too worried about their decision.
Well, to succeed, Ms. Roschke, do we have to agree that the $57,000, roughly, that was the carve-out originally, that $57,000 really was the value of the house, and that all the excess amount that ultimately was received was attributable only to the land and the higher use value of that land?
The commercial potential of that land, yes.
All right. And if that isn't the appropriate standard for the carve-out, then you got a problem.
Ask me that one more time.
If the court should say that the county is not bound by the first carve-out figure it gives you, then you have a problem in your analysis, because your analysis depends on the first carve-out.
Remaining fixed, not changing,
even though later it would appear that maybe the $57,000 was too low. Too bad.
the value of the whole property was too low. But the county could have arguably, well, without legal authority, but at least they could have let Pekowski's know they were going to change their mind on this.
That goes to the equitable estoppel argument. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel. Counsel, representing Milwaukee County.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is, again, Timothy Karaskevich for Milwaukee County. There were a number of questions asked about the timeline, and I'd like to address that very briefly first before I get into my argument. The timeline here, as it was brought out on the direct examination of the airport director at trial by Mr. Markovitz, tells the long story of the very, very long time it takes to have airport expansion plans approved, both at the federal and the local level. And as the direct examination of Airport Director Bateman shows, the planning for the expansion of the cargo runway at Mitchell Airport began in actually 1987. After that planning process, what developed was something called a master plan, an airport master plan. That master plan went before the county board for a series of hearings, and finally, in 1993, the board, Milwaukee County Board, passed a resolution approving the expansion plans for the air cargo runway at Mitchell. Now, obviously, there are any number of federal regulations and other administrative issues that come up before this runway can actually be built. But in their approval of this master plan for the airport expansion, the county board approved the acquisition of what's identified in the trial transcripts attached as the appendix to our brief as the Site 11 properties. And in 1993, Site 11 properties were identified as the Pinkowski property and the property to its north and the property to its south. So as early as 1993, the Milwaukee County Board had identified specific properties that were to be acquired through eminent domain or through negotiated sale.
I just want to ask a question on that because I thought that your own expert basically said that these sales were voluntary. Now, you're giving us, I know the background, and I assume the assumption is these were not voluntary sales. But when at least when I read this, it was my understanding that the expert, your expert, said that these were voluntary sales.
Well,
that's what Judge Wiedemeyer in the appellate court, when he wrote his dissent, he said that he thought that these were arm's-length transactions, that they were voluntary, and
actually, that's not what Mr. Zarum said. Mr. Zarum, in his report, used the word voluntary, but it was not in the legal sense, making a legal conclusion based on all of the facts that these sales actually were voluntary on behalf of the sellers. Mm-hmm. And actually, if you look at the context of Mr. Zarum's comment, he goes through a series of statements regarding the pattern that the acquisitions followed. And he talks more about the county's motivation, having received federal funds for a project and pressed with the expiration of the use of those funds, sought out these transactions in order to conclude them to use the federal funds.
And that would be key in the sense that the precedent here, going back to the Blick case, because that was not voluntary, and if one were to distinguish that case and say, well, that was not voluntary, this was. And so your whole argument is that these were never voluntary sales.
That's exactly it. Even if we apply, for the sake of argument, the minority rule in this case, the rule that allows voluntary sales to come into evidence, the Pinkowskis cannot show that these sales were voluntary precisely because, as I was explaining in the background, since 1987 on through 1993, then in 1996 once again, the county board designated these specific properties for acquisition. And as a result of all of the hearings involved in those resolutions, the noise hearings at the airport for community members to come and voice their opinions regarding yay or nay on the expansion of the cargo runway, the Court of Appeals and the trial court found that everyone in the area knew or should have known that the airport was going to acquire these properties for expansion. Now, what Mr. Markovitz mentioned was an interim use for the property that followed the 1996 resolution of the county board, where the board decided, where the airport pressed the board to approve a parking use for the same properties in addition to the eventual cargo ramp expansion. It's no secret that Mitchell Airport parking, along with the increase in passengers, has required an increase in remote parking. The fact that this property was available and was slated for acquisition in any case for cargo ramp expansion brought airport staff to the realization that it could be used on an interim basis until the cargo ramp and the runway were extended to alleviate some of the parking bind. That was the 1996 resolution by the county board to allow, again, affirming their earlier decision to acquire these properties. Now, as I was saying in response to Justice Wilcox's question, even if you apply the minority rule, these sales here are not voluntary because the county, and we know from the Nichols Treatise and from the cases applying the minority rule, that there are really three prerequisites for an involuntary sale. One is that the authority must have the power of eminent domain. It must also have the authority from whatever source it needs authority to exercise that power. And finally, it has to be committed to an actual project. Now, from these three elements, what arises is an actual threat or compulsion against any seller or on the part of any seller whose property is designated for that project. Well, here we have all three, and the Court of Appeals and the trial court found that all three property owners knew or should have known that the airport was going to be expanded and that it was inevitable that their property would be condemned at some point for an expansion of that runway and parking use after 1996. And the issue, as the both the minority rule courts and the majority rule courts understand, is that the idea underlying the rule is that this evidence is so prejudicial, evidence of sales to a condemner are so prejudicial at trial that it would be almost impossible for a condemnor to persuade a jury not to take a price that was agreed by the condemnor in settlement of claims as the going rate or market value of property. Once that bell was rung at trial, it would be impossible to unring it with as many adjustments as any experts would care to make to the analysis. Another problem with adopting and using the minority rule in this circumstance, or in this context, is the fact that it conflicts with Wisconsin's same project rule. Now, that rule is found at 3209 sub 5. And essentially what the rule tells courts to do is to take away any effect that a condemnor's participation in the marketplace has on the actual market value of a setting of market value for property. We submit, and as recognized by the majority of courts on the issue in Blick and that line of cases, the easiest way to do that and avoid the prejudice of introducing this extraordinary prejudicial evidence is to not admit the sales in the first place. If the sales aren't admitted, the same project statute is complied with, and there's no prejudicial effect on the condemnor.
Is it the county's position that these other sales are not admissible through the expert witness's testimony?
Yes, that's our position as well.
And if you attempted to put the seller of these other properties on the stand?
Yes, I can't see any other way for a condemnor to even begin to attempt to alleviate some of the prejudicial effect of having these property values admitted at trial. And that was really the point in my brief of identifying the type of satellite collateral litigation that this would involve. It would involve a testimony by each of the property owners, each of the representatives of the sellers, all the documents that were provided by the county or whatever condemnor authority was participating, and depositions as well as trial testimony. It wouldn't be enough, as Mr. Markovitz suggests, to simply have the trial judge rule on this, because we would not have the opportunity to fully explore voluntariness with simply an expert's testimony.
So you're concerned that there's going to be a trial within the trial on the basis of voluntariness?
Oh, absolutely.
That is, if you did it in limine.
Absolutely. And I would, as a litigator, I would think that the case would be won or lost on that satellite litigation.
Now, my question is, in these states that adopt the minority rule, what kind of evidence was introduced? The appraiser's evidence or the evidence of the seller?
Well, as you can see from the citations in both of our briefs, the cases are extraordinarily wide variety. And by and large, my recollection is that it was an attempt to introduce specific testimony by a specific individual talking about their specific negotiation for a price for their property. I believe there are, though, scattered cases about expert testimony.
Okay.
Counsel, if I could follow up on that. Should this Court agree that the majority opinion remain, or the majority view remain in Wisconsin, there's still one thing that troubles me, and I'm looking at, again, at 90703, and this, specifically the second sentence. If we're dealing with, and perhaps you can answer this, are we dealing with this, but if we're dealing with evidence, or at least information that the appraiser would normally rely upon to make an appraisal, why wouldn't that, what would be wrong with the appraiser testifying pursuant to 90703?
The first thing that occurs to me, if there were a rule, a legal rule that prevented appraisers from relying on that as a basis for their expert opinion, it wouldn't be available to them. And as it exists now, the Blick rule prevents appraisers from reasonably relying on that type of evidence because it skews the market. It either skews it toward the condemnor or it skews it toward the condemnee. Incidentally, one thing I wanted to point out was that Mr. Zerum's comment about the haste with which Milwaukee County needed to acquire these properties is a good example of how this this kind of transaction skews the market toward the condemnee. Now, Milwaukee County, in this instance, was awarded several kinds of federal funds to expand the cargo ramp and begin the planning process. And as Mr. Zerum points out in his analysis in his appraisal report, the county was under a certain degree of pressure to use that federal money before it actually expired and was withdrawn from the county. So his conclusion was that the county went on and paid too much for the property simply because we had the federal money available and it balanced out the county's expenditure out of its own pocket for that money. That's a good example of how this kind of evidence probably can never be understood or explained to a jury once they understand that a certain dollar amount was paid per foot for a property right next door.
And if I could ask one additional question, the Blick rule, would that rule apply if instead of dealing with the condemnation situation we're dealing with here, we were dealing with a sale to a private purchaser as not part of the condemnation process? In other words, same property being sold to a private purchaser, the adjacent properties on either side as part of your position, as part of the condemnation process. Would the appraiser have been able to testify regarding the adjacent properties in a private sale?
If I understand your question, yes. The appraiser would, under Blick, under that line of cases, would not have been prevented from relying on sales to private parties. Blick only affects or only addresses sales to condemnors because, again, it's only the condemnors' participation in the marketplace that skews the market.
Right, but your position is that the condemnor is involved in the adjacent property sales. So now we're talking about Pinchowski's property in the middle of those. And instead of selling now to the county, if they had sold, say, to a third party, if they had sold to Hertz or to some other entity, would the Blick rule have precluded the appraiser from relying upon the sale to the adjacent properties?
If the county were not a party, even if the county were a party, I would think that the Blick rule would still operate because the principle underlying the Blick rule, the majority rule, is that it's the condemnor's presence in the marketplace. It's the condemnor's presence in negotiations with the condemnee. It's the seller of the property who sits down at the table with the condemnor and understands that the seller cannot walk away from that kind of transaction the same way the seller can walk away from a free market transaction. If I want to buy your house and I don't offer you enough money, you can just walk away and wait for a buyer who's going to pay what you want. When you deal with the condemnor, the last issue at the table is how much is the condemnor going to give me for my house and force me to go to court to get a higher price. So the condemnee, the seller, knows that the property is going to be taken. The question is whether it's going to be taken with litigation, without litigation, and how much is it going to cost.
Counsel, if I understand your answer to Justice Butler, then if a trial court has a divorce and there's a parcel of property and the valuation is contested, if we apply your rule, then we couldn't use these sales if this same property were subject to a contest about its value in a divorce. Is that right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what rules apply in divorce outside the condemnation
context. Just say we're trying to determine the fair market value of the property. That's always the question when you have a contest about what real estate is worth. And if I understand you correctly, if the plaintiffs here were parties in a divorce and were trying to dispute with one another the value of this property, neither of them could use the sales that the county to this county that occurred several years before.
Well, I think that's true, and perhaps this may help explain why. In this case, there were other comparables available, and the expert used 10 comparables that were introduced at trial.
I know, but that never has limited how many comparables are available. It's not a standard that I'm aware of that limits any appraiser. It has to be something that's wrong with the sample, some reason why you can't use that as a sample property.
Well, in answer to your question, then, if market value were the issue,
right,
because the condemnor's participation in the market skews the market value of the property, I would think that in a divorce proceeding it could not be admitted as well.
But when you have condemnation, you end up having a confirmate. Well, never mind. I have enough information. Thank you.
Thanks.
If I understand the trial court's opinion, which is on Appendix 137, referred to previously by Justice Butler, I think, the trial court determined that the sales in question were not the type reasonably relied on by experts because they weren't voluntary and arm's length transactions. Therefore, they didn't come in under 907.03 because experts don't rely on that, okay? If a type reasonably relied on by an expert, then you can do it even if the data is not admissible. Now, 32.09, Section 32.09.1M.
Okay.
All right, I'm sure you can quote that verbatim, but I'll read it.
Well, that
as
would
a
be
basis hard. For determining value, a commission or a court, we're dealing with a court, may consider the price and other terms and circumstances of any good faith sale or contract to sell and purchase contract to sell and purchase comparable property. It then goes on to say a sale or contract is comparable within the meaning of this subsection if it was made within a reasonable time, and then it was Justice Crook's question about time, before or after the date of valuation, and the property is sufficiently similar in the relevant market with respect to situation, usability, improvements, and other characteristics to warrant a reasonable belief that it is comparable to the property being valued. What do you have to say about that section?
Well,
it seems to have its own evidentiary rules.
I'm going to sound like a broken record because the same theme keeps running through everything I say because it's so fundamental to the case. And that is that the condemnor's participation in the transaction is what takes this out of any determination of market value and makes it not a comparable property, in effect. It's that take-it-or-leave-it proposition that the condemnor brings to the negotiating table that makes this not a comparable transaction or not a comparable property to the subject property.
And the reason is because it's inherently unreliable, attendant to the threat of condemnation.
Yes. As soon as a condemnor appears on the scene, ready, willing, and able to negotiate to take someone's property, the seller's on a defensive. There's just no way around that.
And that comes in under 3209-2B. That's that the same project rule.
Yes, that's an element of it as well.
Okay.
You talk in your brief about the importance of not confusing the jury.
Yes.
How does that apply with respect to the second issue, the Hertz letter and the inability of the seller to even tell, well, not just the price, but even explain that that Hertz was interested in this specific property, and why that was important in preparing the appraisal?
Well, both the trial court and the appellate court found that the Hertz letter was such poor and speculative evidence that it couldn't be used by experts by the Pinkowski experts as the basis for any opinion about the market value of the property. It couldn't be used as the expert's opinion to support that assemblage theory as well. The problem with the Hertz letter was that it was not signed on time, so it was expired before it was ever released by the Pinkowskis. The Pinkowskis made interlineations, cross-outs, substitute paragraphs that were never approved by Hertz. There were conditions contained in the letter in the letter itself on Hertz's behalf that were never satisfied by the Pinkowskis in response. So it was the extraordinarily speculative nature of the document itself that, if viewed by a jury, perhaps wouldn't have understood or wanted to understand the subtleties of why this wasn't a significant document. The other issue was that, as the Court of Appeals and the trial court found, the inferences that the Pinkowskis wanted the jury to draw from the Hertz letter were entirely speculative as well. The chief inference was the fact that Hertz would or could have purchased the Pinkowski property and the North and South properties to form an assemblage and build a rental car facility on it. The Court of Appeals in particular was very descriptive about why it thought Hertz couldn't do that, and that was based on the history that I described to you earlier about the airport expansion project. It was that everyone in the area of the airport, particularly those on the airport, knew or should have known as early as 1987 that the county was thinking of expanding the runway. They certainly knew in 1993, when the county board approved a runway through the specific area, that the county, one way or another, inevitably was going to acquire that property and put a runway down. And then finally, in 1996, when the county board agreed to airport staff's recommendation to use that specific piece of property as a parking lot, Hertz knew or should have known that it was going to be a parking lot. Now, Hertz, I suppose, could have snapped it up early after 1996, and we would have bought Hertz out eventually. But Hertz, in their foresight, decided that was a bad business decision and didn't do it.
Counselor, I want you to shift gears a little bit and tell me whether you think the county has the authority to change the value it earlier established for the carve-out value of the
residence. It's difficult to hear.
Does the county have the authority to change the value it earlier set for the carve-out of the home?
Well, that's the chief difference between the county's interpretation of the carve-out, the housing replacement provision,
right,
and the Pinkowskis. The county viewed the carve out as a constant. And under our reading of the statute, which was affirmed by the Department of Commerce, the trial court, the appellate court, the carve-out represented a constant amount to be applied to the purchase price of the house. And when the price paid for the house went up, the carve-out went down. Now, the obvious explanation for that is that the safety net amount provided by the relocation statute is just that, a safety net. It's not a condemnation bonus for getting a great price for your house. The safety net is available when the price of the house on the market brings a very low price, and it's not available when someone gets 3.5 times what they ought to for the house.
But you're paying for the house and you're paying for the lot in both circumstances. And I guess if I understand opposing counsel's argument, is once you determine what that house is worth, just because you pay more for the whole parcel, that isn't going to make the house worth more. And I guess that's kind of what I want you to look at.
No, our position is that the price of the house remained
the same.
Yes. And
but then the amount for the land is quite small in comparison. And so you own in the initial $90-some-thousand offer, right?
Yes.
Okay. And so in the second offer, you're saying that the house value would remain the same, but all the additional money that was paid was for the value of the land.
Well, there are many things that go into a public entity's evaluating a piece of property for acquisition. In this case, we saw Mr. Markowitz representing the Pinkowskis, and we understood that there was a certain premium, and that's factored in. There's a factor that's also contained in estimating what it's going to take for the ultimate use of the property. I mean, if there were significant environmental issues, for example, we would offer less for property than if the environmental issues were greater. There are all kinds of contingencies that go into valuing a piece of property, and that value may change as litigation progresses.
If the value of the house remained at $57,000, and you then paid him $1 million for the property, is that your position? And that you, then why would you increase the value by 3 times, which you did here?
Why would we increase the...
You used a percentage.
Yes.
You said, in effect, that as the whole property price went up, it went up equally, or percentage-wise, on the lot, the land, and the house. So if you started out at $100,000 and it was $50,000, if you then ultimately paid $200,000, what was the house worth?
Still the same 57%.
You just shifted me. You put it in percent. Your answer to Justice Rokensack was in dollar amount. I want to know, did the value of the house...
You're going to force me to do math?
Well, I'm not going to do it in 57. I'm going to do it in 50%.
Okay.
That's why I said you had $100,000 and it was $50,000 and $50,000, right?
I think I'm going to...
Now you ultimately pay $200,000. I want to know, you would say, at least according to your briefs, 50%, the house is now worth $100,000, they bought a new house for
$90,000. No, we would say that the house is worth the same dollar amount that we initially calculated as the carve-out. And that, again, goes back to our interpretation of the statute as a safety net rather than a condemnation bonus. If the relocation payment were allowed to escalate as the price of the entire property escalated, because that's what would happen when you apply the same ratio to a higher price, someone would get more for getting more for their property and buying a more expensive house. Our view, and I think it was affirmed by the Department of Commerce and the Court of Appeals and the trial court, was that this statutory provision exists to ensure someone that they get a minimum payment for which to acquire a new house that was acquired by condemnation.
So this house is worth $57,000, right, according to your calculation?
$53,740.
Okay, 57%, $53,000. They buy a house for $155,000.
Yes.
And they get no relocation costs.
Housing replacement costs.
Housing replacement costs. Why not? Just explain that to me.
Well, because they bought both a house that was more expensive than the original agreed minimum house value, and because the price remained constant for which we would pay a housing replacement.
What was that price?
$24,900, I believe. Mm-hmm. That was the original proposed.
But you didn't give them the $24,000.
No, because once their property was acquired for 3.5 times what we originally offered, and once they purchased a house that was more expensive than the originally designated replacement housing amount, the calculation was, as the Department of Commerce said, too high.
Counselor, you know, when I first did the math on this, when I was making notes on the case, I understood this differently. And opposing counsel got me thinking about something that really wasn't in my calculation. I looked at the amount that was offered as $93,000. You figured out the house was worth roughly $53,000. That leaves you $40,000 for the land, okay? If a replacement house costs $77,000, if you add comparable land, $40,000, and $77,000, you get $117,000 necessary to put them in a house on the lot. If you take $93,000, what you offered them, away from $117,000, you get the $24,000 replacement cost. And I wasn't doing percentages, but perhaps I just looked at it totally wrong. So I need a little help from you.
Well, I have the figures of the original.
That would be great.
If you just give me a second to reorient myself here. Mm-hmm. The original calculations were, and I believe this is page 33 of our brief, the original calculations were that $93,000 approximately was offered for the house and the property. The comparable replacement dwelling was estimated at $77,000, $77,900. The carve-out ratio left an amount for the house of $53,738.
Mm-hmm.
The replacement housing payment then, which is the addition of the amount attributable to the land, which was $39,700, right, and the carve-out for the house of $53,700 was then it's the difference between the comparable replacement dwelling and the carve-out that equals the replacement housing payment.
So you say that again? It's the difference
it's
between?
It's the difference between the comparable replacement dwelling amount, which was
$77,926,
okay, and the carve-out for the house, which was $53,748.
Okay.
That's $24,900.
Where's the replacement housing payment?
$24,900. So they could have gotten something comparable under the statute for $77,900.
Yes.
Your carve-out, which is how much you were paying them for the house.
Yes.
From the 90, it was $53,000. So you owed them $24,900. Okay. And then how did you recalculate?
There is no recalculation involved.
But you didn't give them $24,900.
No. Because once the recalculation, if you're referring to the calculation based on what they ultimately received,
yes,
for the house, goes like this. The total award was $285,000. That was the jury amount.
For what? Everything. Everything. House and lot.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The comparable replacement dwelling was then $77,926. It
stays the same?
Right. It was unobjected to.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 58.7 carve-out, based on the 285 price, was $164,730.
How'd you get the, what did you do, get a percentage?
Well, the carve-out, the amount attributable to the land and the amount of the carve-out for the house will equal the entire award.
Sure. Chief, if I may.
Yes, go ahead.
I know your red light is on, but my question is somewhat basic. This is not my area, so I need your help in this area. I understand that the administrative code calls for a carve-out position.
Yes.
But when the county condemned this property, they condemned the house and the lot itself. When a person purchases replacement housing, they don't just buy a house alone. They buy a house on a lot. So maybe I'm having some difficulty understanding how, when you figure replacement value and the housing of a relocation allowance, you're allowed to just look at the house on the one end, even though it's the house and the lot that's being taken, and when you purchase, you got to buy a house and a lot on the other.
And that's a very good fundamental question. And the reason that this is a more complex calculation than the calculation when someone just goes from a house on a small piece of property to another house on a small piece of property is that this was a small house on a very large piece of property. And then the regulations tell you to go through this complex carve-out calculation. And so you're dealing with the somewhat skewed effect that everyone knows this property is going to, the land itself is going to be more than what the house is worth because that's what the property is being acquired for. It's the land we wanted, not the house.
But the reason I ask the question goes right to the language in sub 4, 3219-4A. It begins, in addition to amounts otherwise authorized by the subchapter. So if we're looking at amount in addition to the amounts, don't you have to compare apples with apples and oranges with oranges? If you're talking about a house and a lot that's being taken, don't you have to consider in a house and a lot for a replacement value?
I would prefer a much less complex calculation, but this is the calculation that the regulations require us to make. And the matter is that we puzzled over the calculations, and we were interested to see what the Department of Commerce said about them. And the Department of Commerce, in essence, said, the calculation's correct, the safety net exists, but it doesn't exist when you sell your house for 3.5 times more.
Thank you.
Chief, if I may.
Yes. Justice Prosser.
I wanted to follow up my question before about the confusion of the jury. The jury heard that Hertz was in the market for other property. The jury heard that the property that Pinkowski's had and the adjacent properties would have really served this purpose. But the jury was not permitted to hear that Hertz actually contacted the Pinkowski's and put on paper an offer to purchase their property. It would seem to me an ordinary juror would have said, all these theories coming from Mr. Markovitz's appraisers are just fantasy. I think the jury would have been confused by that. Tell me I'm wrong.
Well, I think you're wrong.
That was easy.
I think there's something that I failed to bring out that may lead to confusion here. And that is that, in fact, the jury did hear twice during trial, once from Mrs. Pinkowski and once from the airport director, that Hertz had made overtures to the Pinkowskis. Now, counsel points out in his brief that there was an objection to the testimony before the airport with the airport director, and the judge, in response to a number of issues, told the jury not to regard that. But Mrs. Pinkowski actually did testify that Hertz had made overtures and was interested. So that issue was out there, and it was certainly argued in closing arguments. It was argued both for and against. And I don't think there was an argument on our side that said this is a fantasy. I think our argument was that an assemblage is just not a good idea, and we attacked the chronology for the allegation that we engaged in these salami tactics to snatch up the property from the Hertz people before they had an opportunity to get to it. So I think those issues were out there, and our brief actually cites the chronology, or it cites the particular pages in the trial testimony where it came in. I think it's at the very beginning of Mrs. Pinkowski's direct and at the end of, or the very beginning of the airport director's as well. If you have a problem locating that, I'll be happy to submit something. The other issue is that I think the Hertz letter was so bad that admitting it, and this balancing approach under 403 was argued to the trial court, I think the Hertz letter was so bad and so prejudicial that admitting it would have gone too far against the county in light of its very, very slight probative value as not an offer, not an entree to negotiations, but something that had never been agreed to in a timely fashion by the Pinkowskis, and there apparently were no follow-up negotiations. So given the fact that it had very slight probative value, I think the prejudicial effect would have been tremendous. And the charcoal was justified on that ground as well.
Thank you, Counsel.
See, my time is up. Thank you very much. This was my first argument. It was quite an honor to be here, especially in company of Mr. Markovitz.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Markovitz.
I'm going to try to make a few points very briefly. I want to respond to this point that this was a single project with a quote. We've cited this case in our brief. It is the Almoda case, which is a United States Supreme Court decision, and I quote from that case, which says, quote, where multiple properties or property interests are condemned for a particular public project, the government must pay pre-existing market value for each. It would be unjust to allow the government to use salami tactics to reduce the amount of one property's owner's compensation by first acquiring an adjoining piece of property or another interest in the same property from another property owner. So my response in rebuttal is, if we assume for purposes of discussion that this was but a single project, you run head-on into the United States Supreme Court decision in Almoda. The next point I want to make has to do with counsel's argument regarding Hertz. And this is kind of like getting on a merry-go-round and you don't get off. What we wanted to do with the Hertz letter was to establish that Hertz had an interest in acquiring this property. Counsel makes this wonderful argument that standing by itself, it was so speculative and so remote and so unreliable that it should not have been admitted. We then turn to the second and last piece of our complaint about the way Judge Gooley ruled here. We had absolute confirmation of Hertz's interest contained in the appraisal report of the county's expert, which verified every single detail of that interest, that they were interested in it, that this was where they preferred to go, that they only went and looked for other property when this property was no longer available to them.
But ultimately, isn't that the point, that this would have been acquired by the airport anyway, because it was in the way?
But then we come back to Almoda. The county cannot come in here and say, we don't have to pay just compensation for this property because we've sliced off the properties on both sides. All we're trying to say to the jury is, before this all started, there was an interest in the private sector to acquire this property as part of an airport-related assemblage. That's all we wanted to get in front of the jury.
You want to get the price before the jury?
No, we were not seeking it. That's why we accepted the court's ruling that the amount that Hertz was willing to pay was not appropriate because it was not a contract, it was only an offer, and therefore the exhibit that we offered carefully redacted the number, and there was no way the jury could have inferred any particular number from the property. But when our appraiser used what Hertz eventually bought as a comparable sale, then the jury could have seen, well, if Hertz was interested in this property, they couldn't buy it. They went out and they spent whatever it was that they spent to buy the other property. That's an inference that the jury could look at and say, well, if Hertz preferred the other one to this one that they paid this much for, they probably would have paid that much or more for the other property. And I'm not trying to re-argue the case. We were not allowed to put that in front of the jury. Now, the last thing I want to talk about is a little bit about this carve-out issue, which is flying all over the room at the moment. Let me see if I can add a couple of points to it. First, this is an additional amount of compensation which the legislature says a property owner is entitled to beyond just compensation. Justice Butler, I think, quoted the language which said, in addition to everything else that you're entitled to, you're also entitled to this. The record in this case indicates that the Pinkowskis were sent a letter by the county. It's in the record in this case, which said, here's how we have calculated your carve-out. If you go out and buy a house for $77,000 or more, we will give you a relocation replacement payment of $24,000 and some odd.
If you accept our offer.
No, it did not say if you accept our offer.
Really?
It said this is our calculation.
Counsel, just as a preface here, although it's correct that what Justice Butler read in sub 4 and you again emphasize in sub 4, in addition to the amount otherwise authorized, you are also entitled to the following payment, but then that's followed by sub 1. Such payments include only the following. Number 1, the amount, if any, which when added to the acquisition payment equals the reasonable cost of comparable replacement dwelling available in the private market. So
that's what generated the effort for the carve-out principle, because the legislature did not specifically contemplate that the little farmstead could be part of a 100-acre holding. And you cannot say if the farmer is selling the whole 100-acre holding to the Department of Transportation for $1 million that these people do not get their housing replacement allowance, even when the true value of the farmstead is but $50,000 or $75,000. There's an equality, an equal treatment principle that's inherent in this whole program. And the last thing I want to say, coming back to how do you compare these things, you need to visualize two farmers side by side. They each started with 100-acre facilities. The first farmer sold off 97 acres and retained a 3-acre farmstead. If his property is taken for the widening of the road, he gets the fair market value of his 3 acres, and he gets his replacement housing allowance if he qualifies under the formula. The county's approach is if the second farmer hasn't sold off the other 97 acres and he's sitting on 100 acres, which has the same value farmstead sitting on it, because he sold 100 acres and got $1 million for it, he loses his eligibility to be paid his farmstead replacement allowance. That treats identical citizens differently.
Mr. Markovitz, I have to interrupt you because we have to change the disc.
I had finished my comment, and perhaps that's...
I'm not finished.
Oh. I can hope.
The marshal will tell us. Mr. Markovitz.
Yes, ma'am.
Maybe we're talking about two different letters. But under paragraph 42 of the Court of Appeals majority opinion, appendix page 121, in your brief. It says no promise was made that Ms. Pinkowski would receive any housing replacement, regardless of the sale price. The letter explaining the housing replacement formula contained the following information. It says this payment has been determined, blah, blah, blah. And then in italics, but as according to the to Judge Curley, bold in the original, provided you sell your house to Milwaukee County for the above-stated appraisal amount. Now, were you talking about a different letter than I was talking about? Because I said there was a proviso in there.
Let me.
You said no.
Let me refer to two things. First, this says provided you sell your house. We're talking about all of this land in addition to the house. And the other thing I want to talk about, which is part of Ms. Raschke's argument in the brief, I am not suggesting that the county could not do anything different once they issued this letter, that they were locked to the $53,748 amount. But the record in this case indicates that they never came back at any time after that and said, we have recalculated. Now that you are being paid X, Y, or Z, your carve-out amount is now so much. What happened in this case is the Pinkowskis had nothing other than this letter. Let's just stay with this letter. They went out and they bought a house based on this letter. They never received, before they bought the house or after they bought the house, anything from the county that said, we've recalculated your carve-out basis. The only time this issue surfaced is after we pressed the county for the $24,000 amount, they said, we don't owe it to you because we changed your carve-out amount. They never provided any information about it until we saw it in the appellate briefs in which they used this percentage mechanism, which I respectfully submit to the court is an absurd argument. You're looking here at a 1,060-square-foot little house sitting across from the airport on the southern end of Milwaukee County, which probably was worth very close to the $50,000 or $60,000. If you take the county's argument to its ultimate, if this property sold for 10 times, not if the jury fixed a final decision that placed this value at 10 times the $100,000 that they were talking about originally, they would say, well, based on our calculation, your house was worth $500,000. That is an absurd conclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Markovitz.
Thank you.
I want to thank all counsel involved in this case for their excellent arguments on difficult issues in condemnation. That will conclude our hearing on 03AP1732 and 03AP2127. Pinkowski versus Milwaukee County. The court will take a few minutes in recess so these students may leave and other students may come in.
Yep.